Thank you very much. My name is David Bell, and welcome to everybody to this panel on the 2017 French presidential election. I do have to start with an apology, because we had really hoped, we thought we were going to have Jean-Luc Mélenchon here by hologram. And unfortunately, we just have not been able to get this to work. American infrastructure, right? I'm sorry, terribly sorry. In any case, so I'm David Bell. I teach history at Princeton. I write occasionally on French politics. I'm here with Charlotte Cavalier, Erwan Lagadec, and Frédéric Bozo. I will introduce them fully in just a moment, but I just wanted to make some very brief introductory remarks first. So, as you all know, this has been the most volatile election in recent French history. Indeed, in the history of the Fifth Republic, I think it's probably safe to say that at this point. For the first time, there's a president who's not standing for re-election after his first term. For the first time, it's not just possible, but actually probable, that the second round of the election will not feature candidates from either of the two major parties, the Les Républicains or the Parti Socialiste. And while it's not probable, it is still possible that the second round will feature two candidates widely seen as political extremists, Marine Le Pen and Jean-Luc Mélenchon. So we want to talk about what the different scenarios are and the possible effects and consequences. And we want to talk about how useful French history is as a guide to understanding this election. And that last point obviously is going to be of particular interest, I think, to this particular gathering. And I think it's worth thinking for a moment about how we could frame an answer. On the one hand, a great deal of what France is experiencing in this election seems to be part of patterns that extend very far beyond the boundaries of the hexagon. There's the anger at elites, the fears and arguments about globalization, immigrant communities, the power of populism. All of these things seem of a piece with the Brexit movement in the United Kingdom, not to mention the election of Donald Trump here in the United States, the rise of populist strongmen and parties in Eastern Europe. But on the other hand, clearly all the leading candidates in this French election have been shaped by deep French political traditions. In Marine Le Pen, we hear echoes that go back through her father, Jean-Marie, to Pierre Poujade, and then back to the Third Republic. For François Fillon, there's a Catholic conservatism that also connects to very old French traditions, although Fillon, of course, also connects back to the Gaullist tradition. For Mélenchon, we certainly hear echoes of the Programme Commun and even the National Front, the Popular Front, excuse me. And Freudian slip, if ever there was one. And for Macron, I'm reminded of irresistibly of a terrific phrase that was devised by the historian of the French Revolution, Pierre Cernan, to describe the balancing act carried out by generations of post-revolutionary French actors. Pierre Cernan talks about their search for what he calls the extreme center. And I think that fits Emmanuel Macron quite well. So these are some of the things that we're here to discuss this evening. And we're delighted to have these three experts from France who will discuss various aspects of the election with us. They will make brief remarks, really 5 to 10 minutes each, after which we'll have a roundtable discussion and then open things up to the audience, and we have a microphone there to take your questions. So initially we had Simon Serfati, who's listed on the program. He was unfortunately unable to appear, but we were very fortunate to have Frédéric Bozo, who along with Charlotte Cavalier and Erlan Lagadec will speak. I'm just going to introduce the three speakers together right now to save a little time. And then each of them will make their short remarks, and then we will, as I said, proceed to a general discussion and to questions. So Charlotte Cavalier is assistant professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University here in Washington. She received her PhD in government from Harvard in 2014. She studies comparative politics and political economy. She's particularly interested in social rights and changes in mass attitudes towards social policies in advanced capitalist economies, and she'll provide a political science perspective on how things stand today on the eve of the premier tour. Then we will hear from Erwan Lagadec, who's a faculty member at George Washington University, also here in Washington, of course. He has many different hats. He's also a fellow at Johns Hopkins at the School of Advanced International Studies. He does many other things around town here. He has a PhD from Oxford and has worked widely as a consultant on security matters. His latest book is Transatlantic Relations in the 21st Century, Europe, America, and the Rise of the Rest, which appeared with Routledge. And he will talk about the transatlantic defense and security implications of the election. And finally, we have Frédéric Bozeau, who is a professor of European studies at the Sorbonne Paris 3, although he's here in Washington this year on leave at the German Marshall Fund. He studied at the École Normale Supérieure, at Sciences Po, and at Harvard. He received his doctorate from the Université de Paris-Nanterre. He's written very widely on French foreign policy issues. And among his recent books is The History of the Iraq Crisis, France, the United States, and Iraq, 1991 to 2003, which has just been translated from the French by the Wilson Center, and he will talk about issues of France and Europe. But then, of course, the conversation can go on to all sorts of issues, whatever people really want to raise. So again, thank you all for coming, and I'll turn this over without further ado to Charlotte. Thank you.
All right, so unfortunately, I had all these beautiful slides ready for you, and I forgot to open the email that said that there were no projectors. So I'm going to be miming my slides and miming data. The good thing is that there's not much to mime because data doesn't say much for the specific election, you know. So in that sense, I'll go very fast. I just want to briefly mention three issues. What does the data say about who will make it to the second round? And the answer here is, not much, so we'll go fast over that. Is France on the verge of a political realignment? And here I will bring some concepts in political science to try to explain the current situation and where it might go. And then some kind of a bit of data on what we know about the new Le Pen voters. Le Pen, the FN, have been, polling at around 17% kind of forever, since the 80s. And suddenly, bam, they break the glass ceiling. What's going on and what do we know about these new voters who kind of added themselves to the lot? So in terms of who will make it to the second round, the last sondage, enquête d'opinion that I looked at, Macron is at 23%, Le Pen is at 22%, Fillon is at 20%, Mélenchon is at 19%. The confidence intervals overlap. There's just no way to know. Okay, so I'm not even going to try. I'm on record saying that Trump wouldn't win. This is not going to happen this time. The interesting thing for people following the elections is that these specific data sets, one of them run by Sciences Po, has a sample of 15,000 respondents. So the confidence intervals should be really small because you have a lot of data, and they're still pretty big. So just to show you how things are up in the air. One interesting thing, though, in this poll, for people who say that they're very likely to vote for Macron, 52% say c'est un vote par défaut, by default. Okay, for the other candidates, about a third. He's more than half, all right? So, is France on the verge of political realignment? And so the way to explain this is where I do the miming. So, the way political scientists, especially political economists, try to simplify the world is to say that it's this one big cleavage in kind of advanced capitalist countries, the class-based cleavage, the economic cleavage, where on the one hand you have people who are pro-labor, and on the other hand you have people who are pro-capital, and there's a zero-sum relationship there, of course. And so if you're more pro-labor, you're going to have to take some from the capitalist, and this kind of the type of simple models of politics that a lot of our theories are built on, and they usually work. There's a second dimension that has emerged, as you might be aware, and it finally showed up in American politics. A big puzzle was, why were we not seeing that second dimension? And that's a dimension that on one hand pits the Europeanist against the souverainist, the Marine Le Pen calls the globalist versus the patriot. But within that, you can also bring the multiculturalists, and those who are not multiculturalists, and also a kind of more... it's hard to describe, but it's really obvious in the data, what I call positive individualism. And so think new left. Think people where they think of government intervention as there to enable the individual to flourish and kind of emerge from the community in this you know, fulfilling way. So this positive individualism, you worship the individual, but in this way of flourishing and emancipation. And on the other hand, you have negative individualism, which is lack of trust, this idea that we are a bunch of individuals who cannot come together as a community. There's all these free riders out there. I can't trust the other. So it's a very kind of negative individualist vision of society, but not this kind of positive emancipatory vision. So if you put that, so you've got pro-labor, pro-capital, kind of Europeanist, multiculturalist, positive individualist versus the souverainist and the negative individualist at the bottom. And you could start placing the candidates. And what's kind of beautiful with this election, right, is that candidates are all over the place. Okay, so you actually, this is amazing. You have choice. When you think about it, everyone's unhappy by the choice set, but it's one of the most diverse choice set we've ever had. The problem is we can only have one president. Okay, so if you could have four, it would be easier. Everyone kind of, you know, would be represented to some extent. So, Emmanuel, I'm not going to go into all the details, but you get the idea. Jean-Luc Mélenchon is the kind of more pro-labor one. Emmanuel Macron, the economic, is somewhere in the middle, but is the most Europeanist, multiculturalist one. François Fillon is the more, he's made a pro-capital move, and then a kind of down towards the souverainist, assimilationist, non-multiculturalist side. What is really interesting is the Front National. The Front National, historically, is pro-capital. It's anti-tax, anti-big state, anti-welfare state, and anti-immigration, assimilationist, you get the spiel. Well, Florian Philippot basically moved Marine Le Pen towards the pro-labor side. Marion Maréchal Le Pen is the old guard, and so there's this potential for conflict within the party. So the Front National has actually spread out its ideological basis. So, on the one hand, you have a kind of traditional left that had exploded between Emmanuel Macron on the way to Jean-Luc Mélenchon with Benoît Hamon somewhere in the middle. On the other side, you have Fillon and le FN, but EFN that's also pretty divided. So what will happen if we get what people have been trying to predict, which is a Macron-Le Pen duel, which would be a sign that something new has happened because none of the traditional parties are there. So what could happen? Well, considering that Les Républicains was a machine to have Sarkozy elected, this party is going to disappear. As usual, since De Gaulle, there's just this impossibility of creating a true conservative party in France. So some of them are going to go to Macron, and others are going to go to Marine Le Pen, maybe. On the left, and there's evidence of that, by the way. A lot of people have rallied around Macron, voted, now I'm blanking on this name, Juppé in the primaries. So there I've already rallied Macron, and there's still some potential for these guys to move. On the left, some people on the left would meet Macron, kind of. The reason why I'm really worried is that traditionally the left in France, they need some ideology, they need some signals, they need some cues, they need some heuristics. And I'm going to just read an email I got from Macron, because I'm on his mailing list, where he tries to justify his use of the word en même temps. I know everyone speaks French here, so I'm just going to go ahead and read the email. En même temps signifie simplement que l'on prend en compte des impératifs qui paraissent opposés, mais dont la conciliation est indispensable au bon fonctionnement d'une société. Oui, je choisis la liberté et l'égalité. Oui, je choisis la croissance et la solidarité. Oui, je choisis l'entreprise et les salariés, etc., etc. So he's really not trying to create a left-wing ideology, and I just don't think he's going to be able to get these guys on board. So, all right. So if these move towards Macron, which again, I have some doubts on the left, then there's the risk of this division within the Front National, with this tension that I just mentioned to you. So even if there are signs of a realignment around this new dimension of politics, and Marine Le Pen is very astute, I think she's reading pretty well, she could be a sociologist to some extent, there's still this potential for divisions within the FN. Like, personalities matter in the long run. Macron needs to make, I think, a strategic move to create a more kind of left-wing ideology. And the FN needs to deal with this contradiction. It's unclear whether they're capable of doing that. All right, just to finish, who are the new FN voters? So they come from the left. So the Philippot shift has worked. Okay, 18% of these new voters, according to this panel data that I was mentioning, voted François Hollande in 2012 or an other left-wing candidate, 9%. So that's a total of 25% of the new voters that are coming from the left. The others are coming from Sarkozy, basically. Okay, they voted Sarkozy in 2012. However, a lot of these people coming from the left are doing it as a vote par défaut. And I think it's because they don't feel that some of the issues they care about are represented on the left. And what is that? It's immigration. So that's definitely there. And the terrorist attack seems to have played quite a large role. The second thing that's harder to capture, but that I think is really important, is the economy. And so what I mean by the economy, it's not whether you lost your job or not, because actually in France, unemployment was so high they didn't add that much, unfortunately. And also the welfare state actually worked really well, so France is one of the only countries where poverty did not increase during the recession, poverty rates. However, what French sociologists have called déclassement is very high, which is this perception that you're doing worse than your parents. And that's been kind of showing up in the media, but it's also in the data. This is not invented to some extent. And so people who feel this sense of downward mobility, which overlaps also with the Trump voters, are voting more for the FN. The second thing, for those who haven't read Piketty's work, one thing you need to know about France, don't look at income, because the income distribution is very equal, and it's been the same for a long time. Look at real estate. And so there, young people can't buy houses. When they buy houses, and I had all these nice graphs to show you, but when they buy houses, it's because the parents have given them cash. France is one of the worst countries in the OECD when it comes to intergenerational transmission of wealth, especially when it comes to real estate. So even though it's not showing in income, labor income data, I think if you look at real estate and all that kind of fixed assets, and you look at Piketty's work, he's been talking a lot about that for France. All right, let's stop there. Sounds good?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So as I was looking at the topic of the transatlantic effects of the elections, I soon morphed into something that's pretty foolhardy to do when Frédéric Bozo is in the room, is to look at what's left of Gaullism as a paradigm of French international affairs in this election. So I did a pretty blunt assessment of what the programs of the candidates tell us on this. It's interesting because it starts with pretty clear soon enough that Gaullism absolutely remains the sacred cow, at least in terms of how the parties present themselves. No great surprise that François Fillon describes himself as a Gaullist, but Macron, we just talked about, what was the phrase, en même temps? So if you look at his program, he says that he's both in the Gaullist tradition and also in the Mitterrand tradition. Which, he must have not read the coup d'etat permanent. But intriguingly, Mélenchon, of course, we will not characterize himself as a Gaullist, except he utilize the Gaullist sacred cow when he refers to de Gaulle's decision in 1966 to remove France from the integrated command at NATO, and he seems to imply that that de Gaulle was wise in doing this, and so why did Sarkozy return to the integrated command? All of these guys they tick all the boxes in terms of characterizing their role as restoring the independence and autonomy of a French foreign policy. They also are very keen on the language about France as a balancer of global international relations, so not a regional power, but one that, due to a very specific voice in the world, can speak to all nations and all people and balance among world powers, on which more in a second. That's where we come to sort of the diagnostic here indicator is if you mention rang and grandeur in your program, and yes, they all do essentially. Now, if you turn to force de frappe, and I'm sorry, I have a laundry list of items here. Force de frappe and nuclear deterrent essential. Yes, they absolutely all of them are on the same line. The only one, Mélenchon, he only takes issue with the force de frappe insofar that He wants to remove the airborne nukes from the French arsenal, but he has no issue with the submarines, SSB, and so that's the extent of your Trotskyist that's the extent of his pacifism. Is he wants to remove airborne nukes. On the presidential, the goal is presidentialism, especially in regards to the domain réservé and the capacity to shape foreign policy at the highest levels of vital French interests, instead of, say, the Quai d'Orsay. I mean, of course, Macron, Fillon are on the same line. Marine Le Pen, yes, would be, frames herself as a very strong president, except that she would inject some citizen empowerment by way of referenda at the domestic level. The exception, of course, is Mélenchon and his Sixth Republic, which is clearly designed as an anti-Gaullist move away from what he calls the regal presidency. On the on the Gaullist two-step dance vis-à-vis the U.S. is, Mélenchon wants to remove, Mélenchon and Marine Le Pen would want France to go back to the De Gaulle policy vis-à-vis NATO from 1966 and removing France from the integrated command structure. Indeed, well, Mélenchon is the only one who breaks with De Gaulle in the sense of he has no subtlety vis-à-vis his relationship with the U.S., which De Gaulle certainly had a basic paradigm that when push came to shove, as it did during the missile crisis, his solidarity lay with the U.S. Well, that certainly isn't true of Mélenchon, who goes so far in that sense of wanting to remove France from NATO itself. A couple of things on Germany. Frédéric will talk more about this. I will simply point out that Fillon also brings back a bit of a nostalgia for checkbook diplomacy, because his idea, which is interesting, that he seems to think he can sell this to the Germans, is he wants Germany to pay for French military deployments abroad, which will make for interesting politics. And on Russia as a natural partner, well, Mélenchon certainly is more so than Marine Le Pen, actually. He has been very keen on framing the right place for Europe as in part, for France as part of this Gaullist Europe from the Atlantic to the Ural. Fillon is kind of on the same line, of course, except with the proviso that he wants the Minsk agreements to still remain the condition for normalization of relations with Moscow. So that's the basic picture. What the prima facie, what it would look like, De Gaulle is in business again for very simple reasons that you see his doubt that the U.S. could ever be serious about securing Europe. That doubt is back in play, because that is the gist of what Trump has to say about the U.S. security guarantees, either that he's gone vis-à-vis Europe or that he will only come and fight and on behalf of Article 5 if the Europeans can show that they are spending 2%, they are sending 2% of their GDP in the NATO coffers, which is not how this works, so there's an issue there. And second, of course, the Brexit, should the UK leave the EU, we're back to the sort of Europe that De Gaulle might want to see, not only the part where the UK is out as the Trojan horse, but also it looks like De Gaulle back in business with the multi-speed Europe of Nations, the sort of Fouché plan Europe that he had in mind. If you look at the Jean-Claude Juncker from the European Commission, came out last month with a set of five scenarios where he could see Europe evolving, and at least two of them are pretty close to the multi-speed Europe of Nations that De Gaulle had in mind. That being said, if I had to describe the obstacles that stand in Gaullism's way, number one, you can't stand above parties if there are no such thing as parties anymore. That's a bit of an issue. Presidentialism took a la De Gaulle. I mean, Mélenchon and his Sixth Republic are absolutely anti De Gaulle on this. The whole idea of presidentialism, the regal presidency, of course, suffered from the quinquennat first, that sort of watered down the special status of the presidency vis-à-vis Parliament, and then the hyper-président in Sarkozy and the président normal in Hollande. The next piece about De Gaulle as the great master narrator of France's roman national is probably gone because there is no such thing as roman national anymore. And the imagined community is having a hard time imagining itself as a community. And lastly, I would say De Gaulle, let's not forget that what he could pull off in the international arena was also based on underlying economic resources and the Trente Glorieuse, and that's gone as well. Now, which means at the international level, if we define more or less goldism as a strategy of independent and full sovereignty of, that finds the geopolitical space for France to punch above its weight, well, it looks like we live in the sort of world where we're struggling to come up with any strategy. Globalization certainly means that we have a hard time even framing, defining what an independent foreign policy might look like within or without the EU, doesn't matter. In this era of the multi-stakeholder, what Joe and I would describe as this multi-level chessboard, there is less than, states no longer have a monopoly on power. That's a world that De Gaulle really doesn't have any much relevance to anymore. The key point, I suppose, is that De Gaulle had found the space for France to leverage power and punch above its weight in the era of bipolarity. The space that he had found was such that he was going to be the power in between. Then you move on to multipolarity. That's Jean-David Levitt and Chirac reinventing the way that France was going to be able to punch above its weight. That was being the champion for this multipolar world order. That takes us to the Villepin speech, February 2003, that Frédéric will know all about. What if we live in this apolar world, leaderless world, that leaves us with, we need a reinvention of the way that France is going to punch above its weight? And I'm not entirely sure. It looks like the only solution to the quandary is for France to be one of the solid leaders of that leaderless world, and I doubt it can pull this off. So, conclusion. Prima facie, again, it looks like because of what's going on in the US and in the UK that we are in business for a resurgence of Gaullism from the Atlantic to the Ural and so on and so forth. But we have issues with the narrative really struggling with what is happening right now to strategy, to sovereignty, to independence. We also have issues with the fact that, Gaullism, in spite of the narrative being, and precisely to the extent that his narrative about what France was, who France was, precisely because it was high-minded, it allowed him to be genuinely pragmatic about how he navigated international affairs. He was not a theologian, and we're at risk to have only one legacy from Gaullism, which is that we are now theologians about what we think he would, the great man, would have wanted. Second is De Gaulle, with combination of pragmatism, high-minded description of France, but also lying to France about what it was and what its recent history had been. So there's this implicit lie there to the country about who we were that is inherent in Gaullism. And if we only now are left with revering the sacred cow of the Gaullist narrative with no pragmatism, with no results to show for it, we are left with a theology that's lying to you. That's not necessarily good news. That's it.
Okay. Well, if I say that the European ramifications of this election are huge, I would not hit you very much. David, I think you summarized things very well. This election in France is coming on top of a major European crisis, the Eurozone crisis, the migrants crisis, Brexit, Russia, Ukraine, and the Trump election. And by the way, Trump basically endorsed Marine Le Pen today, implicitly, at least. If you have that in mind, it's clear that the French election, its results will have enormous importance in terms of whether the dominoes will continue to fall or whether the unraveling will stop. And pressure on the French voters is actually huge in that sense. The European ramifications are also considerable in the sense that all of the above is obviously reflected in the debate, or actually the non-debate, I would say, in a second. Because what you see is clearly a conflicted electorate between continued support, basically, for European construction, although that support is small some decades ago, and at the same time, dissatisfaction with the way the European Union has evolved. Of course, the debate is also about globalization, and the dissatisfaction is clearly about European unification having failed, basically, to shield the French and the others from the effects of globalization. So the globalization and the European debate are inseparable in that election. And so the result of this is that this is probably the most significant European vote since 2005, the European Constitution, if not 1992, the Maastricht Treaty. And central in this are Franco-German relations. On the one hand, they are still considered by most French people as almost sacrosanct in a way, as a a legacy of history that no one wants to shatter. On the other hand, there's clearly this growing dissatisfaction with what is essentially becoming an unbalanced relationship, and the feeling that the way Europe is evolving is more and more the German way and less the French way. This is not new, but it is now in full light, I think, and I think it underpins the European aspect of this election. So this was my first point. The stakes are enormous for the future of Europe. Second point is that given the enormity of the stakes, the least that can be said is that one can have mixed feelings about the nature, about the quality of the debate in that election on Europe. More in general, the debate on international affairs, as Erwan has said, was somewhat lackluster. We know why. Issues, quote unquote, have dominated the debate hindered the debate in many ways. And of course, we're witnessing the collapse of the traditional party system, and that is not very conducive to an orderly debate. And that includes, of course, the European question, which now divides both the right and the left. And so the result of this recomposition, which Charlotte has described, is, of course, is the consequence of this European and global discussion and reordering. And so the result is that, on the one hand, most candidates offer strong and varied European visions, though they are not always very clear-cut, I must say. And sometimes they are quite blurred. And those visions range from pro-EU to anti-EU. Though it's also stunning to stress that only three candidates actually do not consider at some point leaving the EU. And this is Benoît Hamon, François Fillon, and Emmanuel Macron. All the others, the other eight, are either for immediate Frexit or Frexit, if. So a huge variety of European visions, but on the other hand, there has been no serious debate between those visions. And those visions, there has been a juxtaposition of those visions without a serious debate. So all the foregoing means that the next president, two major debates have not taken place. One, the most fundamental debate: should we continue European construction or should we stop it? And two, if it is to be continued, how do we reorient it? How do we redress it? How do we correct it? Those debates have not taken place, and as a result, the next president will have a strong option without those discussions having been done or waged. So since, David, you asked us for scenarios, I have three scenarios. Of course, I now understand what the Russian influence on the election is about, and it's about turning it into a Russian roulette, because there are four candidates that that could make it to the second round. And so that math teaches me that this means there are six possibilities. One of them is probably lethal. And this is my first scenario, in a sense. The nightmarish scenario, in my view, of Mélenchon-Le Pen second round, which essentially means two populists have won the first ballot. And the next president will be one of those populists. I'm using the word populist for lack of a better word. We can discuss that. I'm sure Charlotte has more to say about this than I. But let's say the two populists are in the second, in the runoff. I submit that this is as close as you can get to Frexit, to a Frexit vote. Now, I agree, I recognize that there's a difference between a Le Pen victory, which seems unlikely, and a Mélenchon victory, which seems more likely, if only because of Le Pen's xenophobia and Mélenchon's universalism. In a sense, Mélenchon is easier to deal with than Le Pen in European terms. But I'm not sure there's a huge difference between the two when it comes to the European question. In the short term, this is April 24th, basically, if the two make it to the runoff. Or if Mélenchon wins in the second round, if he has made it to the second round, which he could do faced with Le Pen or faced with Fillon, according to polls. So in the short term, either April the 24th or May the 8th, it's an earthquake, basically. Watch the markets. This is going to be much worse than Brexit, because France is part of the Eurozone. This is a major Franco-German crisis. We'll say it's not personal, but it is. And the Germans will understand it as such, with very little room for a quick settlement of the kind that took place after the rejection of the EDC in 1954. So this is going to be a protracted moment of crisis. In the long run, I think it's important to stress that Frexit probably doesn't mean Frexit, to speak like Theresa May. Because unlike Brexit, if this is a Frexit vote of the kind I've described, there will be many opportunities for buyer's remorse. Frexit cannot take place without first the legislative election, giving whoever is elected president a majority for that policy. I'm not sure either Mélenchon or Le Pen could have such a majority. And then there is a need for at least two referendums, one on Frexit, and before that, one on changing the constitution, which says that we are part of the EU. So my bet is that Frexit eventually won't happen. In the meanwhile, there's ample room for a huge crisis. And I must say, leaving even aside Le Pen's scenario, that Mélenchon's scenario for a plan A, which is about renegotiating treaties along his lines, is totally fanciful. There's simply no way there's going to be any kind of agreement, even with probably with Greece today, on the kind of propositions that he is putting forward for renegotiating those treaties. And since Plan B is probably not going to take place for the reasons I've just said, that is Brexit, there's going to be a very long crisis. And I think the jury is still open. Will France eventually cave in? In other words, will Varoufakis, who is Mélenchon's hero, turn out to be Tsipras? That could very well happen. Or will there be some kind of a constructive discussion to reorient Europe? I really very much doubt it on the basis of Mélenchon's suggestions or proposals. Will there be a splintering of the EU as a result of this vote? It's entirely possible. Whether that will be an orderly or disorderly splintering remains to be seen. In any case, there will be an important role for historians, and certainly for historians of Franco-German relations. Okay, so two more scenarios. For a Europeanist like me, the most desirable, of course, is a Macron-Fillon second round, because there are the candidates who, I'm leaving aside Hamon for reasons that we can discuss, have reasonable propositions in terms of changing the EU. It's too bad that this debate has not taken place. I hope it will take place for the second round, because they have two very different approaches to how you fix Europe. Macron basically says we need to resume European integration and finish the incomplete job of Maastricht. In other words, we have a monetary union without an economic union, let alone a political union, so we have to move in that direction, and more integration, so France will reform itself, and the Germans will be ready to discuss more integration. That's what he's saying. It remains to be seen whether the Germans are ready for that. Even a Schulz victory, we can discuss that, probably will not be enough to convince them. Fillon says, let's not talk about more integration. Let's shift the focus of European construction to issues of sovereignty, border control, defense, migration. And by the way, we will stop talking about transfers and bothering you Germans with transfers. In a sense, Fillon ends the hypocrisy, the Franco-German hypocrisy. The French have been saying to the Germans, we want a more integrated Europe, but we're not ready for the surrendering sovereignty, and the Germans have been saying we want a federal Europe, but they are not ready for transfers. So there is a Franco-German hypocrisy that could stop, actually, if Fillon wins. So that could be also interesting. The good news is that both want to restore France's economy and status, and I submit that both are probably in a position to do so, and that would in itself recreate a Franco-German balance, which of course is a precondition for moving forward. Final scenario, probably the most likely according to polls, Le Pen-Macron second round, which probably, incidentally, would probably, I don't know what Charlotte thinks, but would probably lead to a less clear-cut Macron victory than polls now predict, but probably still a Macron victory. Perhaps this is the debate we need, because it is a debate about Europe versus sovereignty, about globalization versus territorialism. Of course, the danger is if it becomes a new referendum on Europe, it's dangerous, we know that. But on the other hand, if Macron wins, well, maybe there is room for a new start.
To ask of the presenters, I want to thank them for these wonderfully lucid presentations. But I think since we have so many people here, I think we should simply open it up to questions. So we have a microphone here, and if people would like to simply step up and ask questions, and this can lead to a discussion. So, please. Personne.
Oh, tout à fait correct.
Everything is clear about this election. No. Okay, please.
It's right there.
Okay. Thank you very much for those fascinating overviews and insights into contemporary French politics. I'm sure I'm not the only person here who's been thinking about the attentat that just took place, and I wonder if you have anything to say about how that might change or not change what you think will happen on Sunday. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So
the mic that you have on should work.
I think it's for the video. I'll speak up. So I can't. There's no data, and I'm like, so in that sense, it doesn't exist, right? So what we know in instances where there has been data is that yes, it has mattered. This specific instance, I'm less concerned personally, but that's totally informal because this Cherfi guy went for two policemen. To some extent, in the French culture, they're kind of on the front line. The people who think that policemen are not well treated have already decided who they're going to vote for, it seems in the data. So I'm not expecting this to affect it that much. However, I'm not in France right now, so I'm only picking up from my friends, and so. But in terms of what we know from the data, it needs to be something where it's civilians hit. It's kids in Nice. So in that sense, I'm kind of hopeful that it's going to be okay in that sense. You know, it's not going to be like Clinton when the FBI released or called her up for another meeting, right? We'll see.
What I would say is the closest parallel that comes to mind is Atocha in Madrid, March 11th, 2004. Sorry,
they did mic us, but these mics don't seem to be working, so I think we'll have to pass this around.
It was just for the recording.
Oh, just for the recording. Okay, there wasn't.
Yeah, I was saying the parallel of Atocha in Madrid on March 11th, 2004, the attack on the commuter trains 2 days before the general election in Spain. The differences, I would say, is number one, well, we are not in at the time it looked like PPE and José María Aznar was cruising to victory. Circumstances were the Iraq crisis, where the demand from the attackers were for Spain to remove its troops from Iraq. I suppose it's also about Aznar tapping into grievances vis-à-vis Franco and its lack of transparency, when Aznar initially blamed ETA for the attacks. It seems to me, number one, the French by now have it's sad to say, but have this pretty much drilled to a knot in terms of the transparency that's needed. And you see François Moulin, our procureur de Paris, now one of the most famous people in France, explain what just happened in as much detail as he can. And number two, I would say it's not necessarily the case that there would be a rally around the flag around Marine Le Pen, as though she was the only one who promised to be tough on this and increase you know, the French security apparatus and so on, because only Macron has ideas of his own instead of in terms of you know, security, intelligence, and beefing up Sentinel and so on. So it's not like if she has the field to herself of being tough on this stuff.
No, I can only add some you know, gut feeling on this, and
I think you're missing.
Oh, I lost something here. Oh yeah. Okay. All right.
So I'll ask you to find a white.
Okay. Do you have any trust? C'est bon, je pense.
C'est bon.
Is that?
Am I here?
No.
Oh, that's my. No. Maybe we should tweet instead.
Gosh.
No. Jeez. You've killed it, Frederick.
All right.
Well, no, we're good. We're good.
I was saying we should tweet instead of speaking in the microphone. Uh-huh. So I think I share your views both, and I think basically terrorism has been factored in the political debate since at least probably the last election, which was preceded by the Mera attacks in March of 2012. And also, I mean, what I see personally in society is resilience, basically. You know, the fact that hate crimes have you know, gone down by 40% last year in a country that has been, you know, targeted by mass terrorism says a lot about, you know, a certain amount of lucidity and you know, moderation, basically. So, and by the way, Le Pen hardly campaigned on this at all. Which I think reflects what I've just said. She didn't think it would sell very much until yesterday, actually. Fillon did more of this and is, I think, more likely to gain from it than Le Pen because he comes across as more competent than she does. Mm. But we'll see.
I mean, yeah, just line up, I guess. Yeah. Sorry, I'm taking it.
I need both. Okay. So I have two questions. In view of what we see as sort of the dissolution of traditional parties, formations, and I wonder what you can say, what you can predict about voter turnout, because we know in France voter turnout is usually fairly high, particularly compared with the United States. My second question has to do with, regardless of who's elected, we really don't have a good idea of how France will be governed, because we need to talk about the legislative elections in June. Should worst-case scenario Marine Le Pen be elected, I mean, she has two right now. I mean, that probably is not going to happen, but it'll make my point. We have the Front National has two seats in the National Assembly of 577. Even in her wildest dreams, how many seats could that? She never would have a majority. So my question really is about, with this, again, it's to do with this recomposition of the political parties and its effect on the longer-term governance of the country.
Yeah, so on turnout, yeah, okay, all right. On turnout, according to the last data, it's 72%, I think. I think the major issue is if Macron passes, it's all the people from Nuit Debout. They're just not going to turn out. So, and not sure if they're very well captured by the data. So it's like this new left-wing movement. So in that sense, turnout is going to be lower. But I still think she'll lose, to be honest, if it's a Macron-Le Pen thing. You're totally right on the how you're going to govern this country. Especially, I think it's going to be a problem for the right, because the left have already rallied around Macron, and you know, they've all hung out in government, they all know each other, they all go to dinner together, they all went to the same schools, they're best friends, it's fine. Like, they're going to have these networks, they're going to be activated. On the right, the elites in the Républicains, they're actually not that anti-immigrant. Like, to some extent, all the elites who had any intellectual proximity to Le Pen have already shifted, and so they're going to be stuck in making a strategic move to move really to the right on these issues, where according to data that I've seen, all the députés from the right are not you know, they're pro-Europe, they're not anti-immigration per se. And so for them, it's really about going to make a strategic move of where do I go if I want to keep on winning elections and be able to collaborate with someone to pass a set of laws. And so I think it's going to be a real conundrum for the right. That's kind of how I see it.
I see that Le Pen wants to now reintroduce purely proportional elections at all levels. But, you know, what strikes me is, to the extent that we can compare what's about to happen to Trump, being binational myself and looking back at when we wake up on November 9th, this fear that, and even on January 20th, that the Republic as we know it might be gone. It's interesting that you see, Trump, if you see Trump as, candidate Trump as a revolutionary who wanted to, a la Bannon, take on and dismantle the administrative state. Well, Marine Le Pen and Mélenchon, if not Hamon, who also speaks of a Sixth Republic, it seems to me, what's incredible is the extent to which what they have in mind implies that they are revolutionaries. I mean, we would be spending a hell of a lot of time that we don't have in coming up with changes to the Constitution, whether it be vis-à-vis our status in the EU or coming up with a constitutional convention and so on. Now, what we saw with Trump is that he did not know how to pull off a revolution, or he did not want to, and he tried to fit a revolution into a system that essentially has been preserved. And it seems to me that now we're seeing the extent to which that puts him in this situation where it looks like he's betraying most of his promises, in the sense that his promises could not work except if he genuinely dismantled the system. And now you've got Bannon complaining about the deep state pushing back against these attempts and then creating this glass ceiling or something. Now, we're going to test in any of these scenarios, especially the more spooky ones that you described, Frédéric, we're going to test the French deep state. Now, in principle, De Gaulle is supposed to have created the tools for the president to be able to fight it with more sort of potency than the U.S. president can. Say the ultimate fear is Article 16 of the French Constitution. Let's see what happens. But, yeah, I trust that, in fact, you know, in Le Pen and Mélenchon, we're seeing people who claim they are revolutionaries but do not want and cannot pull it off, and so they are going to fail.
Yeah. Just two words to add to this. I think when it comes to the issue of the legislative majority, I see three scenarios. One is either a Mélenchon or a Le Pen victory, in other words, a populist victory, in which case there will be cohabitation, almost clearly, because, I mean, there will be buyer's remorse by voters, and I don't see how either of them can get a majority. If it's Fillon, it's the most predictable because, you know, it's the old game of effet majoritaire, and it's clear that Fillon will get a majority in spite of his issue. In a sense, the most interesting case is a Macron victory because he doesn't really have a party. He's, of course, preparing for the election. But the effet majoritaire, of course, is in doubt. Also, he wants to change the voting system for the National Assembly with at least a healthy dose of proportional voting, which is probably a good thing. And so it would be an interesting experiment, I think. And probably something that would bring us as close as you can get under the French system to the German system, mm-hmm. You know, grand coalitions and the like.
I just have a quick...
Yeah.
Can I
sure.
add
I just have a quick follow-up to this question, actually. I mean, it seems... Up till now, because Hamon has been so marginalized, there's been, you know, all four of the leading candidates are able to pose as the kind of change candidates that they are opposed to the present system. But does this continue in the second round if Macron's in the second round, or is it possible that, you know, if it is Le Pen Macron, that she can effectively tar Macron because of his connections with Hollande, because of his elite background, to say this is the system that we're voting against, and could that change the dynamic in her favor?
She'll try.
but would it work?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So, because I'm thinking about, especially what you said also, if it's a Macron Le Pen, I mean, there's two stories, right? Some people want him to be associated with the old guard centrist and be like, okay, let's vote for him. He looks normal or he looks stable.
The word normal no longer works because of François Hollande, unfortunately.
Yeah. That's true. So in that sense, but for me, I think everything lies in the personality of Macron, and I don't like saying that. That's not how now I see the world. I don't think personalities matter. But I think he really has this moment where he could totally shift to this new cleavage and politicize Europe and start this debate over Europe, finally have it, bring in the issue of immigration. When he said that, you know, France has committed this crime against humanity for colonization, he was basically opening this potential door to bring in an immigrant second generation, the kind of young people who were find that the approach to immigration is problematic. It's a latent issue that can be repoliticized. And we don't know exactly what would play out, because when something is not politicized, you can't measure it. Like, people are not thinking about it when they're talking and answering surveys. So I could say Europe of immigration, he has the opportunity to totally shift everything, and I think he would have a majority, actually. I mean, we'll see.
Okay.
But will he do it? And he was my TA at school.
Oh.
I do not trust him. So yeah,
tell us about your grades.
I can't remember, but I wrote a paper on the state. I remember
that's
that.
That's still valid,
undoubtedly. Interesting.
Can I briefly sing the praises of the two-round presidential system? Because we're coming out of the Brexit vote and the Trump votes, were in both cases the one piece of information that voters did not have was the reality of what everything else was about to vote for. And then you wake up with too much buyer's remorse the next day. So the French genius in having the chance to fill the blank of that last piece of information. So this is how insane we are. Let's do something about it now. I like the change from waking up on June 24th and 9th, and November 9th, realizing that we were a different country than we thought we were. Mm-hmm.
So, more questions, please.
There's already a transition going on here in the conversation from what I think drew us to French history in many respects, the sophistication, the analysis of the policies and that sort of thing. But we haven't talked a lot about personality and whether all the French are willing to vote for a woman or somebody who's never held electoral office or any of the personality factors. Can you treat some of those issues, please?
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you too.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm wondering, that's interesting. You know, the more... The more I'm in the U.S., the more I realize we don't really... French political science is not collecting data with that in mind. So, and to be honest, the data I've been talking about briefly is the first time we have so much data. I'm trying to think. If you guys, do you have something on that? Because I'm.
No.
Because what I know of the American data is that it's not because people seem okay that actually it works. So for the women component, I think in Le Pen's case, it's not a woman; it's a genealogy, a dynasty. So I don't think she's a good example. So I would kind of consider there's no women in the election running right now, to some extent. I call it the revenge of the blonde. It's Le Pen, Vladimir Putin, and Trump. would they be willing to vote for someone who doesn't have experience in power? So again, I don't know if you get to have some insights on that. I would say they're fine with it, but. Yeah.
I don't know. I like to think that ideas count more than personalities when you choose, the political orientation. I.